The following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello, and welcome to the fourth reading of Camino Island by John Gresham. I'm Rosina Chevalier. Before we begin, let me explain that this book is read in its entirety. However, some of the reading may still contain explicit descriptions that some people may find objectionable. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. Bruce Cable eventually bought a huge Victorian house. He met a woman who decorated it for him, and they fell in love and married. Mercer Mann is being recruited to get close to Bruce, as the insurance company believes he now has the Fitzgerald manuscripts. Now we continue with Camino Island. You said in an interview with the campus paper that you hoped to finish the novel while in Chapel Hill. Any progress? How did you find that? It was 3 years ago when I first arrived. Elaine smiled and looked out a window. We haven't missed much. She was calm and relaxed, and she spoke in a deep voice that exuded confidence. She and her mysterious company were holding all the cards. Mercer wondered how many of these clandestine missions Elaine had put together and directed during her career. Surely she had faced foes far more complicated and dangerous than a small-town book dealer. The lantern was on Franklin, a few blocks past the hub of student activity. The driver dropped them off at the front door, and they went inside, where the cozy dining room was almost empty. Their seat was near the window, with the sidewalk and street just a few feet away. In the past 3 years, Mercer had read many rave reviews of the place in local magazines. The awards were piling up. Mercer had scanned the menu online and was starving again. A waitress greeted them warmly and poured tap water from a pitcher. "Anything to drink?" she asked. Elaine yielded to Mercer, who quickly said, "I need a martini, up, with gin and dirty." "I'll have a Manhattan," Elaine said. When the waitress was gone, Mercer said, "I suppose you travel a lot." "Yes, too much, I guess. I have two kids in college. My husband works for the Department of Energy and is on a plane 5 days a week. I got tired of sitting in an empty house." "And this is what you do? You track down stolen goods?" "We do a lot of things, but yes, this is my primary area. I've studied art my entire life and sort of stumbled into this line of work. Most of our cases deal with stolen and forged paintings. Occasionally some sculpture, though it's more difficult to steal. And there is a lot of theft these days in books, manuscripts, ancient maps. Nothing, though, like the Fitzgerald case. We're throwing all we have at it, and for obvious reasons." "I have a lot of questions." Elaine shrugged and said, "I have a lot of time." "And they're in no particular order. Why doesn't the FBI take the lead in something like this?" "It does have the lead. Its rare asset recovery unit is superb and hard at work. The FBI almost broke the case within the first 24 hours. One of the thieves, a Mr. Steengarden, left a drop of blood at the crime scene, just outside the vault. The FBI caught him and his partner, one Mark Driscoll, and locked them away. We suspect that the other thieves got spooked and disappeared, along with the manuscripts. Frankly, we think the FBI moved too fast. Had they kept the first two under intense surveillance for a few weeks, they might have led the FBI to the rest of the gang. That seems even more likely now, with the benefit of perfect hindsight." Does the FBI know about your efforts to recruit me? No. Does the FBI suspect Bruce Cable? No, or at least I don't think so. So there are parallel investigations, yours and theirs. To the extent that we don't share all information, then yes, we are often on two different tracks. But why? The drinks arrived and the waitress asked if there were any questions. Since neither had touched a menu, they politely shooed her away. The place was filling up quickly, and Mercer glanced around to see if she recognized anyone. She did not. Elaine took a sip, smiled, set her glass on the table, and thought about her answer. If we suspect a thief has possession of a stolen painting or book or map, then we have ways of verifying this. We use the latest technology, the fanciest gadgets, the smartest people. Some of our technicians are former intelligence agents. If we verify the presence of the stolen object, either we notify the FBI or we go in. Depends on the case, and no two are remotely similar. You go in? Yes. Keep in mind, Mercer, we are dealing with a thief who's hiding something valuable, something our client has insured for a lot of money. It doesn't belong to him, and he's always looking for a way to sell it for big money. That makes each situation rather tense. The clock is always ticking, yet we have to show great patience. Another small sip. She was choosing her words carefully. The police and FBI have to worry about such things as probable cause and search warrants. We're not always constrained by these constitutional formalities. So you break and enter? We never break, but sometimes we enter, and only for purposes of verification and retrieval. There are very few buildings we cannot ease into quietly, and when it comes to hiding their loot, a lot of thieves are not nearly as clever as they think they are. Do you tap phones, hack into computers? Well, let's say we occasionally listen. So you break the law. We call it operating in the gray areas. We listen, we enter, we verify. Then, in most cases, we notify the FBI. They do their thing with proper search warrants, and the art is returned to its owner. The thief goes to prison, and the FBI gets all the credit. Everybody is happy, perhaps with the exception of the thief, and we're not too worried about his feelings. With her third sip, the gin was settling in, and Mercer began to relax. So, if you're so good, why not just sneak into Cable's vault and check it out? Cable is not a thief, and he appears to be smarter than the average suspect. He seems very cautious, and this makes us even more suspicious. A false move here or there, and the manuscripts could vanish again. But if you're listening and hacking and watching his movements, why can't you catch him? I didn't say we were doing all that. We may, and soon, but right now we just need more intelligence. Has anyone in your company ever been charged with doing something illegal? No, not even close. Again, we play in the gray, and when the crime is solved, who cares? Maybe the thief. I'm no lawyer, but couldn't the thief scream about an illegal search? Maybe you should be a lawyer. I can't think of anything worse. The answer is no. The thief and his lawyer have no clue that we're even involved. They've never heard of us, and we leave no fingerprints. There was a long pause as they concentrated on their cocktails and glanced at the menus. The waitress hustled by, and Elaine politely informed her that they were in no hurry. Mercer eventually said, "It looks as though you're asking me to do a job that could possibly involve getting into one of your gray areas. which is a euphemism for breaking the law. At least she was thinking about it, Elaine thought to herself. After the abrupt termination of lunch, she was convinced Mercer was history. The challenge now was to close the deal. Not at all, Elaine reassured her. And what law might you be breaking? You tell me. You have other people down there. I'm sure they're not going away. I'm sure they'll be watching me as closely as they're watching cable. So it's a team of sorts, a group effort, and I'll have no idea what my invisible colleagues might be doing. Don't worry about them. They are highly skilled professionals who have never been caught. Listen, Mercer, you have my word. Nothing we ask you to do is even remotely illegal. I promise. You and I are not close enough to make promises. I don't know you. Mercer drained her martini and said, I need another. Alcohol was always important in these meetings, so Elaine drained hers too and waved at the waitress. When the second round arrived, they asked for an order of Vietnamese-style pork and crab spring rolls. Tell me about Noel Bonnet, Mercer said, easing the tension. I'm sure you've done your research. Elaine smiled and said, yes, and I'm sure you went online this afternoon and checked her out. I did. She's published 4 books now, all on antiques and decorating the provincial way. So she's revealed something of herself. She tours a lot, speaks a lot, writes a lot, and spends half the year in France. She and Cable have been together about 10 years and seem to be quite the pair. No children. She has 1 prior divorce, none for him. He doesn't go to France much because he rarely leaves the store. Her shop is now next door to his. He owns the building and 3 years ago kicked out the haberdashery and gave her the space. Evidently, he has nothing to do with her business, and she stays away from his, except for entertaining. Her 4th book is about their home, a Victorian just a few blocks from downtown, and it's worth a look. You want some dirt? Do tell. Who doesn't like dirt? For the past 10 years, they've told everyone that they're married, got hitched on a hillside above Nice. It's a romantic story, but it's not true. They're not married, and they appear to have a rather open marriage. He strays, she strays, but they always find their way back. How in the world would you know this? Again, writers are blabbermouths. Evidently, some are rather promiscuous. Don't include me. I wasn't. I'm speaking in general terms. Go on. We've checked everywhere, and there's no record of a marriage, here or in France. A lot of writers pass through. Bruce plays his games with the women. Noel does the same with the men. Their home has a tower with a bedroom on the 3rd floor, and that's where the visitors sleep over, and not always alone. So, I'll be expected to give up everything for the team? You'll be expected to get as close as possible. How you choose to do that is up to you. The spring rolls arrived. Mercer ordered lobster dumplings in broth. Elaine wanted the pepper shrimp, and she chose a bottle of Sancerre. Mercer took 2 bites and realized the first martini had deadened everything. Elaine ignored her second drink and eventually said, May I ask something personal? Mercer laughed, perhaps a bit too loud, and said, Oh, why not? Is there something you don't know? Lots. Why haven't you been back to the cottage since Tessa died? Mercer looked away, sadly, and thought about her response. It's too painful. I spent every summer there from the age of 6 through the age of 19. Just Tessa and me, roaming the beach, swimming in the ocean, talking and talking and talking. She was much more than a grandmother. She was my rock, my mom, my best friend, my everything. I would spend 9 miserable months with my father, counting the days until school was out so I could escape to the beach and hang out with Tessa. I begged my father to let me live with her year-round, but he would not allow it. I suppose you know about my mother? Elaine shrugged and said, "Just what's in the records." She was sent away when I was 6, driven crazy by her demons, and I suspect by my father as well. Did your father get along with Tessa? Don't be ridiculous. Nobody in my family gets along with anybody else. He hated Tessa because she was a snob who thought my mother married badly. Herbert was a poor kid from a bad section of Memphis who made a fortune selling used cars, then new ones. Tessa's family was old Memphis with lots of history and heirs and such, but no real money. You've heard the old saying, too poor to paint and too proud to whitewash. That's the perfect description of Tessa's family. She had 3 children. Yes, my mother, my Aunt Jane, and my Uncle Holstead. Who would name a kid Holstead? Tessa. It came from her family. And Holstead lives in California? Yes. He fled the South 50 years ago and moved into a commune. He eventually married a druggie, and they have 4 children, all total whack jobs. Because of my mother, they think we're all crazy, but they're the real loonies. It's a glorious family. That's pretty harsh. I'm actually being kind. None of them bothered to attend Tessa's funeral, so I haven't seen them since I was a kid. And believe me, there are no plans for any reunion. October Rain deals with a dysfunctional family. Was it autobiographical? They certainly thought so. Holstead wrote me a filthy letter that I considered framing. That was the last nail in the coffin. She ate half a spring roll and followed it with water. Let's talk about something else. Good idea. You said you have questions. And you asked why I haven't been back to the beach cottage. It will never be the same, and the memories will be hard to deal with. Think about it. I'm 31 years old, and the happiest days of my life are behind me, in that cottage with Tessa. I'm not sure I can go back. You don't have to. We'll rent a nice place for 6 months, but your cover works better if you use the cottage. Assuming I can, my sister uses it for 2 weeks every July, and there may be some other rentals. Aunt Jane takes care of it and occasionally rents it to friends. A Canadian family takes it every November. Jane winters there from January through March. Elaine took a bite and then a sip of her drink. Just curious, Mercer said. Have you seen it? Yes, 2 weeks ago, part of the preparation. How does it look? Pretty, well cared for. I'd like to stay there. Still a bunch of rentals up and down the beach? Sure. I doubt if much has changed in 11 years. The area has sort of an old-time vacation feel to it. The beach is beautiful and not crowded. We lived on that beach. Tessa had me up with the sun, checking on the turtles, the new arrivals that made their nests during the night. You wrote about that. A lovely story. Thank you. They finished their drinks as the entrees arrived. Elaine approved of the wine, and the waitress poured some in both glasses. Mercer took a bite and put down her fork. Look, Elaine, I'm just not up to this. You've got the wrong person, okay? I'm a terrible liar, and I'm just not good at deceiving people. I cannot wiggle my way into the lives of Bruce Cable and Noel Bonnet and their little literary gang and come away with anything that might be valuable. You've already said this. You're a writer living at the beach for a few months in the family cottage. You're hard at work on a novel. It's the perfect story, Mercer, because it's true. And you have the perfect personality because you're genuine. If we needed a con artist, we wouldn't be talking right now. Are you afraid? No. I don't know. Should I be? No. I've promised you that nothing we put before you will be illegal, and nothing will be dangerous. I'll see you every week. You'll be there. I'll come and go. And if you need a buddy, male or female, we can arrange to have one nearby. I don't need a babysitter, and I'm not afraid of anything but failure. You'd be paying me a lot of money to do something I can't begin to imagine, something important, and you obviously expect results. What if Cable is as smart and tough as you think he is and reveals nothing? What if I do something stupid and he gets suspicious and moves the manuscripts? I can see a lot of ways to screw this up, Elaine. I have no experience and no clue. And I love your honesty. That's why you're perfect, Mercer. You're direct, sincere, and transparent. You're also very attractive, and Cable will immediately like you. Are we back to sex? Is that part of this job description? No. Again, what you do is up to you. But I have no idea what to do, Mercer said, raising her voice and catching a glance from the nearest table. She lowered her head and said, "Sorry." They ate for a few minutes in silence. "You like the wine?" Elaine asked. "It's very good, thank you." "It's one of my favorites." "What if I say no again? What do you do then?" Elaine tapped her lips with her napkin and drank some water. "We have a very short list of other possible writers, none as interesting as you. To be honest, Mercer, we're so convinced you're the perfect person that we've put all of our eggs in your basket. If you say no, we'll probably scrap the entire plan and move on to the next one." "Which is?" "I can't go into that. We're resourceful, and we're under a lot of pressure, so we'll move fast in another direction." "Is Cable the only suspect?" "Please, I can't talk about that. I can tell you a lot more when you're down there, when you're good and committed and the two of us are walking on the beach. There's a lot to talk about, including some ideas about how you should proceed, but I won't go into it now. It is, after all, quite confidential." "I get that. I can keep secrets. That's the first lesson I learned with my family." Elaine smiled as if she understood, as if she trusted Mercer completely. The waitress poured more wine and they worked on their entrees. After the longest silence of the meal, Mercer swallowed hard, took a deep breath, and said, "I have $61,000 in student debt that I can't get rid of. It's a burden that consumes every waking hour, and it's making me crazy." Elaine smiled again as if she knew. Mercer almost asked if she knew, but really didn't want the answer. Elaine put down her fork and leaned on her elbows. She tapped her fingertips together softly and said, "We'll take care of the student loans plus the $100,000. 50 now, 50 in 6 months. Cash, check, gold bars, any way you want it. Off the books, of course." Lead weights suddenly lifted from Mercer's shoulders and evaporated into the air. She stifled a gasp, put a hand to her mouth, and blinked her eyes as they quickly moistened. She tried to speak, but had nothing to say. Her mouth was dry, so she sipped water. Elaine watched every move, calculating as always. Mercer was overwhelmed by the reality of instantly walking away from bondage of student debt, a nightmare that had burdened her for 8 years. She took a deep breath. Was it actually easier to breathe now? and attacked another lobster dumpling. She followed it with wine, which she really tasted for the first time. She would have to try a bottle or two in the coming days. Elaine smelled a knockout and moved in for the kill. How soon can you be there? Exams are over in 2 weeks, but I want to sleep on this. Of course. The waitress was hovering, and Elaine said, I want to try the panna cotta. Mercer? The same, and with a glass of dessert wine. With little to pack, the move took only a few hours, and with her Volkswagen Beetle stuffed with her clothes, computer and printer, books, and a few pots and pans and utensils, Mercer drove away from Chapel Hill without the slightest trace of nostalgia. She was leaving behind no fond memories and only a couple of girlfriends, the kind who'd keep in touch for a few months and then be gone. She had moved and said goodbye so many times she knew which friendships would endure and which would not. She doubted she would ever see the two again. She would head south in a couple of days, but not now. Instead, she took the interstate west, stopped in the lovely town of Asheville for lunch and a quick walk around, then chose smaller highways for a winding trip through the mountains and into Tennessee. It was dark when she finally stopped at a motel on the outskirts of Knoxville. She paid cash for a small room and walked next door to a taco franchise for dinner. She slept a proper 8 hours without a single interruption and woke up at dawn ready for another long day. Hildy Mann had been a patient at Eastern State for the past 20 years. Mercer visited her at least once a year, sometimes twice, never more than that. There were no other visitors. Once Herbert finally realized his wife was not coming home, he quietly went about the process of a divorce. No one could blame him. Though Connie was only 3 hours away, she had not seen her mother in years. As the oldest, she was Hildy's legal guardian, but much too busy for a visit. Mercer patiently went through the bureaucratic challenge of getting checked in. She met with a doctor for 15 minutes and got the same dismal prognosis. The patient was the victim of a debilitating form of paranoid schizophrenia and separated from rational thought by delusions, voices, and hallucinations. She had not improved in 25 years, and there was no possible reason for hope. She was heavily medicated, and with each visit, Mercer wondered how much damage the drugs had done over the years. But there was no alternative. Hildy was a permanent ward of the mental hospital and would live there until the end. For the occasion, the nurses had foregone the standard white pullover gown and dressed her in a baby blue cotton sundress, one of several Mercer had brought over the years. She was sitting on the edge of her bed, barefoot, staring at the floor when Mercer walked in and kissed her on the forehead. Mercer sat beside her, patted her knee, told her how much she'd missed her. Hildy responded only with a pleasant smile. As always, Mercer marveled at how old she looked. She was only 64, but could pass for 80. She was gaunt, almost emaciated, with snow-white hair and the skin of a ghost. And why not? She never left her room. Years earlier, the nurses had walked her out to the rec yard once a day for an hour or so, but Hildy had eventually balked at that. Something out there terrified her. Mercer went through the same monologue, rambling on about her life and work and friends and this and that, some true, some fiction, none of it apparently hitting the mark. Hildy seemed to process nothing. Her face was fixed with the same simple smile, and her eyes never left the floor. Mercer told herself that Hildy recognized her voice, but she wasn't sure. In fact, she wasn't sure why she even bothered with the visits. Guilt. Connie could forget about their mother, but Mercer felt guilty for not visiting more often. 5 years had passed since Hildy had spoken to her. Back then, she had recognized her, uttered her name, and even thanked her for stopping by. Months later, Hildy had turned loud and angry during a visit, and a nurse intervened. Mercer often wondered if the medication was now juiced a bit more when they knew she was coming. According to Tessa, as a younger teenager, Hildy had loved the poetry of Emily Dickinson. So Tessa, who visited her daughter often during the early years of her commitment, had always read poetry to her. Back then, Hildy would listen and react, but over the years, her condition had deteriorated. "How about some poetry, Mom?" Mercer asked as she pulled out a thick, worn copy of Collected Poems. It was the same book Tessa had brought to Eastern State for years. Mercer pulled over a rocking chair and sat close to the bed. Hildy smiled as she read and said nothing. In Memphis, Mercer met her father for lunch at a Midtown restaurant. Herbert lived somewhere in Texas, and with a new wife whom Mercer had no interest in either meeting or discussing. When he'd sold cars, he talked about nothing but cars, and now that he scouted for the Orioles, he talked of nothing but baseball. Mercer wasn't sure which subject held less interest, but she gamely hung on and tried to make lunch enjoyable. She saw her father once a year, and after only 30 minutes remembered why. He was in town, supposedly checking on some business interests, but she doubted it. His businesses had flamed out in spectacular fashion after her first year in college, leaving her to the mercy of student lenders. She still pinched herself to make sure it was true. The debts were gone. Herbert moved back to baseball and rambled on about this high school prospect and that one, never once inquiring about her latest book or project. If he had read anything she had published, he never said so. After a long hour, Mercer was almost missing the visits to Eastern State. Unable to speak, her poor mother was not nearly as boring as her windy and self-absorbed father. But they said goodbye with a hug and a kiss and the usual promises to get together more often. She said she'd be at the beach for the next few months finishing a novel, but he was already reaching for his cell phone. After lunch, she drove to Rosewood Cemetery and put roses on Tessa's grave. She sat with her back against the headstone and had a good cry. Tessa was 74 when she died, but youthful in so many ways. She would be 85 now, no doubt as fit as ever and busy roaming the beach, collecting shells, guarding the turtle eggs, sweating in her gardens, and waiting for her beloved granddaughter to come play. It was time to go back, to hear Tessa's voice, to touch her things, to retrace their steps. It would hurt at first, but Mercer had known for 11 years that the day would come. She had dinner with an old high school friend, slept in her guest room, and said goodbye early the following morning. Camino Island was 15 hours away. She spent the night in a motel near Tallahassee and arrived at the cottage, as planned, around noon. Not much had changed, though it was now painted white and not the soft yellow Tessa had preferred. The narrow drive of oyster shells was lined with neatly trimmed Bermuda grass. According to Aunt Jane, Larry, the yard guy, was still taking care of the place, and he would stop by later to say hello. The front door was not far from Fernando Street, and for privacy, Tessa had lined her boundaries with dwarf palmettos and elderberry shrubs, now so thick and tall that the neighbors' homes could not be seen. The flower beds where Tessa had spent the mornings away from the sun were filled with begonias, catmint, and lavender. The porch columns were covered with ever-creeping wisteria. A sweet gum tree had grown considerably and shaded most of the small front lawn. Jane and Larry were doing a nice job of landscaping. Tessa would be pleased, though she would certainly find ways to improve things. The key worked, but the door was jammed. Mercer shoved it hard with a shoulder, and it finally opened. She stepped into the great room, a long, wide space filled with an old sofa and chairs in one corner, facing a television, then a rustic dining table that Mercer did not recognize. Behind it was the kitchen area, surrounded by a wall of tall windows with a view of the ocean 200 feet away beyond the dunes. All of the furniture was different, as well as the paintings on the walls and the rugs on the floors. It felt more like a rental than a home, but Mercer was prepared for this. Tessa had lived there year-round for almost 20 years and kept it immaculate. Now it was a vacation place and needed a good dusting. Mercer walked through the kitchen and went outside onto the wide deck filled with aging wicker furniture and surrounded by palm trees and crepe myrtles. She brushed dirt and cobwebs off a rocker and sat down, gazing at the dunes and the Atlantic, listening to the waves gently rolling in. She had promised herself she would not cry, so she didn't. Children were laughing and playing on the beach. She could hear but not see them. The dunes blocked the view of the surf. Gulls and fish crows cawed as they darted high and low above the dunes and the water. Memories were everywhere, golden and precious thoughts of another life. Tessa had practically adopted her when she became motherless and moved her to the beach, at least for 3 months each year. For the other 9 months, Mercer had longed to be at this very spot, sitting in these rockers in the late afternoon as the sun finally faded behind them. Dusk had been their favorite time of the day. The glaring heat was over. The beach was empty. They would walk a mile to the south pier and back, looking for shells, splashing in the surf, chatting with Tessa's friends, other residents who came out late in the day. Those friends were gone now, too, either dead or sent away to assisted living. Mercer rocked for a long time, then got up. She walked through the rest of the house and found little that reminded her of Tessa. And this was a good thing, she decided. There was not a single photo of her grandmother to be found. Only a few framed snapshots of Jane and her family in a bedroom. After the funeral, Jane had sent Mercer a box of photos and drawings and puzzles she thought might be of interest. Mercer had kept a few of them in an album. She unpacked it along with the rest of her assets and went to the grocery store to get some of the basics. She made lunch, tried to read but couldn't concentrate, then fell asleep in a hammock on the deck. Larry woke her as he stomped up the side steps. After a quick hug, each commented on how the years were treating the other. He said she was as pretty as ever, now a fully grown woman. He looked the same, a bit grayer and more wrinkled, his skin even more leathered and beaten by too much time in the sun. He was short and wiry, and wore what appeared to be the same straw hat she remembered as a child. There was something shady in his past. Mercer couldn't recall it at the moment, and he had fled to Florida from somewhere far up north, maybe Canada. He was a freelance gardener and handyman, and he and Tessa had always bickered over how to care for the flowers. "You should have come back before now," he said. "I suppose. You want a beer?" "No. Stopped drinking a few years back. Wife made me quit." "Get another wife. I've tried that, too." He'd had several wives, as Mercer remembered things, and he was a terrible flirt, according to Tessa. She moved to a rocker and said, "Sit down, let's talk." "Okay, I guess." His sneakers were stained green and his ankles were caked with grass clippings. "Some water would be nice." Mercer smiled and fetched the drinks. When she returned, she twisted off the top of a beer bottle and said, "So, what have you been up to?" "The same, always the same. And you?" "I've been teaching and writing. I read your book. I liked it. I used to look at your picture on the back and say, 'Wow, I know her. Known her for a long time. Tessa would have been so proud, you know?'" "Indeed, she would have. So what's the gossip on the island?" He laughed and said, "You've been gone forever, and now you want the gossip?" "What happened to the Bancrofts next door?" she asked, nodding over her shoulder. "He died a couple of years ago, cancer. She's still hanging on, but they put her away. Her kids sold the house. New owners didn't like me. I didn't like them." She remembered his bluntness and efficiency with words. "And the Hendersons across the street?" "Dead. She and I swapped letters for a few years after Tessa died. Then we sort of lost interest. Things haven't changed much around here." "The island doesn't change. Some new homes here and there. All the beach lots have been built up. Some fancy condos down by the Ritz. Tourism is up, and I guess that's good. Jane says you're going to be here for a few months." "That's the plan. We'll see. I'm between jobs, and I need to finish a book." "You always loved books, didn't you? I remember stacks of them all over the house, even when you were a little girl." "Tessa took me to the library twice a week. When I was in the fifth grade, we had a summer reading contest at school. I read 98 that summer and won the trophy. Michael Kwan came in second with 53. I really wanted to get to 100. "Tessa always said you were too competitive. Checkers, chess, Monopoly, you always had to win. I guess. Seems kind of silly now." Larry took a drink of water and wiped his mouth on the sleeve of his shirt. Gazing at the ocean, he said, "I really miss the old gal, you know. We bickered nonstop over the flower beds and the fertilizer, but she would do anything for her friends." Mercer nodded but said nothing. After a long silence, he said, "Sorry to bring it up. I know it's still tough." "Can I ask you something, Larry? I've never talked to anyone about what happened to Tessa. Later, long after the funeral, I read the newspaper stories and all that, but is there something I don't know? Is there more to the story?" "No one knows." He nodded at the ocean. "She and Porter were out there, 3 or 4 miles, probably within view of land, and the storm came out of nowhere. One of those late summer afternoon jobs, but a pretty nasty one." "Where were you?" "At home, puttering. Before you could turn around, the sky was black and the wind was screaming. The rain was thick and blowing sideways. Knocked down a bunch of trees. Power was out. They said Porter got off a May Day, but I guess it was too late." "I was on that boat a dozen times, but sailing was not my thing. I always thought it was too hot and too boring." "Porter was a good sailor, And as you know, he was crazy about Tessa. Nothing romantic. Hell, he was 20 years younger. I'm not so sure about that, Larry. They were awfully friendly. And as I got older, I became suspicious. I found a pair of his old deck shoes in her closet one time. I was snooping around like a kid will do. I didn't say anything, but just listened harder. I got the impression Porter spent a lot of time around here when I was gone. He was shaking his head. No, don't you think I'd know it? I suppose. I'm here 3 times a week, and I keep an eye on the place. Some dude hanging around? I wouldn't miss it. Okay, but she really liked Porter. Everybody did. A good guy. Never found him, never found the boat. And they searched? Oh, yes. Biggest search I ever saw. Every boat on the island was out there, including me. Coast Guard, helicopters, a jogger found Tessa up at the North Pier at sunrise. As I remember it, was 2 or 3 days later. She was a good swimmer, but we never used life jackets. It wouldn't matter in that storm. So no, we'll never know what happened. I'm sorry. I asked. I'd better go. Anything I can do for you? He stood slowly and stretched his arms. You have my phone number? Mercer stood too and gave him a light hug. Thanks, Larry. It's good to see you. Welcome back. Thanks. Late in the day, Mercer kicked off her sandals and headed for the beach. The boardwalk began at the deck and rose and fell with the dunes, which were off limits and protected by laws. She ambled along, as always, looking for the gopher tortoises. They were endangered, and Tessa had been a fanatic about protecting their habitat. They lived off the sea oats and cordgrass that covered the dunes. By the time she was 8 years old, Mercer could identify all the vegetation, the sand burrs, beach stars, yuccas, and Spanish bayonets. Tessa had taught her about these plants and expected her to remember from summer to summer. 11 years later, she still remembered. Mercer closed the narrow boardwalk gate behind her, walked to the edge of the water, and headed south. She passed a few beachcombers, all of whom nodded and smiled. Most of them had dogs on leashes. Ahead, a woman walked directly toward her, with her perfectly starched khaki shorts and chambray shirt and cotton sweater draped over her shoulders. She looked like a model straight out of J. Crew catalog. The face was soon familiar. Elaine Shelby smiled and said hello. They shook hands and walked together, stepping barefoot in the sea foam. "So how's the cottage?" Elaine asked. "It's in good shape. Aunt Jane runs a pretty tight ship." Did she ask a lot of questions? Not really. She was happy that I wanted to stay here. "And you're clear until early July?" "Around July 4. Connie and her family will have it for 2 weeks, so I won't be around. We'll get you a room nearby. Any other rentals for the cottage?" "No, not until November. You'll be done by then, one way or the other." "If you say so." "Two initial ideas," Elaine said, quickly getting down to business. It appeared to be an innocent walk on the beach, but it was actually an important meeting. A golden retriever on a leash wanted to say hello. They rubbed his head and exchanged the usual pleasantries with his owner. Walking again, Elaine said, "First, I'd stay away from the bookstore. It's important that cable comes to you, not the other way around." "And how do I arrange that?" "There's a lady on the island, Myra Beckwith, a writer you might have heard of." "Nope. Didn't think so. She's written a pile of books, really raunchy romance novels, and she uses 12 pen names. She once sold well in that genre, but she's slowed down with age. She lives with her partner in one of the old homes downtown. She's a big woman, 6 feet tall and broad, a real bruiser. When you meet her, you won't believe she's ever had sex with anybody, but she has an impressive imagination. A real character, very eccentric and loud and colorful, and she's sort of the queen bee of the literary crowd. Of course, she and Cable are old friends. Drop her a note, make the introduction, tell her what you're doing here, the usual routine. Say you'd like to stop by for a drink and say hello. Cable will know about it within 24 hours. Who's her partner? Lee Train, another writer you might have heard of? Nope. Didn't think so. She aspires to write literary fiction, really impenetrable stuff that the stores can't give away. Her last book sold 300 copies, and that was 8 years ago. They're an odd couple in every sense of the word, but they'll probably be a hoot to hang out with. Once they know you, Cable will not be far behind. Simple enough. The second idea is a little riskier, but I'm certain it will work. There's a young writer named Serena Roach. Bingo. Someone I've heard of. Never met her, but we have the same publisher. Right. Her latest novel came out a few days ago. I saw a review. Sounds dreadful. That's not important. What's interesting is that she's touring, and she'll be here Wednesday of next week. I have her email. Drop her a note. Give her the spiel, and say you'd like to have coffee and so on. She's about your age, single, and it could be fun. Her signing will be the perfect reason for you to visit the store. And since she's young and single, we can expect Cable to be on his best behavior? With you in town for a spell, and with Ms. Roach on tour, there's a chance Cable and Noel might host a dinner after the signing. By the way, Noel is in town these days. I'm not going to ask how you know this. Quite simple. We went antique shopping this afternoon. You said this might be risky. Well, over drinks, it might come out that you and Serena have never met until now. A convenient coincidence, maybe. Maybe not. I don't think so, Mercer said. Since we have the same publisher, it seems believable that I would stop by and say hello. Good. There will be a box delivered to your cottage in the morning at 10. It's a pile of books, all four of Noel's and the three by Serena. Homework? You love to read, right? That's part of my job. I'll also throw in some of Myra's garbage just for fun. Total trash, but quite addictive. I could find only one of Lee Train's books, and it will be in the collection. I'm sure she's out of print, and with good reason. Not sure I'd bother. I couldn't finish chapter one. Can't wait. How long are you here? I leave tomorrow. They walked in silence, still at the water's edge. Two kids on paddle boards splashed nearby. Elaine said, "When we were having dinner in Chapel Hill, you had questions about the operation. I can't say much, but we are quietly offering a reward for information. A couple of months ago, we found a woman who lives in the Boston area. She was once married to a book collector who deals in the rare stuff and is known to handle books with shady backgrounds. Evidently, the divorce was fairly recent, and she's carrying some baggage. She told us that her ex-husband knows a lot about the Fitzgerald manuscripts. She thinks he bought them from the thieves and quickly flipped them out of fear. She thinks he got $1 million, but we haven't been able to trace the money, nor has she. If it happened, it was probably an offshore deal with hidden accounts and such. We're still digging. Have you talked to the ex-husband? Not yet. And he flipped them to Bruce Cable? She gave us his name. She worked in the business with her ex until things went sour. so she knows something about the trade. Why would he bring them here? Why not? This is home, and he feels secure. As of now, we are assuming the manuscripts are here, but that's a rather significant assumption. We could easily be wrong. As I've said, Cable is very smart and clever and knows what he's doing. He's probably too savvy to keep them in a place that would be incriminating. If there's a vault under the bookstore, I doubt he would store them there. But who knows? We're just guessing, and we'll continue to do so until we have better information. What kind of information? We need a set of eyes inside the store, specifically inside his first edition's room. Once you get to know him and start hanging around the store, buying books, showing up at author events, and so on, you will gradually develop a curiosity about his rare stuff. You'll have some old books that Tessa left behind, and these will be your entree. How much are they worth? Does he want to buy them? We have no idea where these conversations might go, but at least we'll have someone on the inside, someone he does not suspect. At some point, you'll hear something. Who knows what, when, and where? The Fitzgerald heist might be dinner conversation. As I said, he drinks a lot, and alcohol causes loose lips. Things slip out. It's hard to believe he'd let that slip. True, but the slip might come from someone else. What's crucial now is to have eyes and ears on the inside. They stopped at a south pier and turned around and headed north. Elaine said, "Follow me," and they walked to a boardwalk. She opened the gate and they climbed the steps to a small landing. She pointed to a two-story triplex at the far end and said, "The one on the right belongs to us, for now anyway. That's where I'm staying. In a couple of days, someone else will be there. I'll text you their number." "Will I be watched?" "No. You're on your own, but you'll always have a friend just in case. And I'd like an email every night, regardless of what's going on. Okay?" "Sure." "I'm leaving now." She held out her right hand, and Mercer shook it. "Good luck, Mercer, and try to think of this as a vacation at the beach. Once you get to know Cable and Noel, you might actually enjoy them and have some fun." Mercer shrugged and said, "We'll see." We have come to the end of the book hour and today's reading of Camino Island by John Gresham. The preceding program was a production of Sight Into Sound Radio.